So welcome back. Session number 4. Hard to believe there's one more to go. Wow. Goes fast, goes fast. So who is, I know of at least two people who are new here this evening. Anybody else new? Ah, very good. Okay, welcome. So 3. As I was mentioning, I said that, you know, the first time I came, I felt like I was dropped into the middle of something. And so I left and thought, well, I'll wait till it starts over again or the beginning. And then you just realize you still feel like you were dropped in the middle of something. So you start wherever we are, and it'll be good. You'll get a good introduction to some of the principles from today and next week. So you're welcome. And I'm happy to stay after, answer any questions for folks who maybe haven't been reading as much or their first time walking into a Buddhist Gampa, and then so I'll answer questions. And then Brian's been a member for a while, and Hetty, who's out front greeting people, she's been a member for a while. So either one of the three of us can help you out. So, I love this cartoon. It's been on my refrigerator a little too long. And if you can't see it in the back, it said, "They told you wrong, pilgrim. Happiness is over the next hill." Which is what we keep trying to do. One more hill. It's got to be over there. Or if I just buy this new trinket, that'll make me happy. And usually it never does. So, I put my email address up here. Please feel free to email me. I've gotten several emails, good discussions, and so that's always good. Now, who asked the question last week? I don't think she's here, about the Buddha and how he could not accrue any more negative karma. Not here yet. So she might be listening or listen to it. So I asked Geshe-la last week. I don't think he liked it too much when I said the Buddha floated over the ground. He just like looked at me. But that's correct. Like once you're a Buddha and you're enlightened, you can't accrue any negative karma. You have all positive states of mind, perfect bliss. And he said it wasn't like today. He wasn't driving a car. They weren't walking a lot. So there wasn't that risk of stepping on insects like we have here. And he said, and he was very careful, he would have never have stepped on an insect. So when you're enlightened, you're that in tune with what's happening in the world around you. So I thought that was a great question, or a great answer to that question. He said, ooh, very practical question. So let's do a meditation, and then we'll see about questions from last week, probably waiting on karma until after we finish the discussion. But if you have a burning question before we do that, that's fine. So if you brought cell phones in, which I added tonight, make sure you put them on pause. I mean, on mute. All right. And then sit in a comfortable position, the 7-point position, if that's comfortable for you. And for those who are first time here tonight, that handout is available on our website, and I'll give you that link at the end. And just take a few deep breaths. And let go of any other thoughts that you're having. And the best way to do that is to focus on an object. So just focus on your breath as it comes, as you breathe in and breathe out, either as you inhale through your nose. Maybe it feels cool. Maybe it tickles a little. Just notice the sensation. Notice the sensation when you exhale. And just focus as if nothing else mattered in the world. razor sharp focus at the tip of your nose. And if that's not comfortable or easy, you can also focus at the rise and fall of your belly. Again, razor sharp focus. When a thought arises, don't follow it. Let it float by. If you catch yourself following a storyline, as soon as you realize, pull back to your breath. That's the practice. And just think about your intentions for being here tonight. Such a beautiful day. Daylight's lasting much longer. So many things you could have done, especially after a long day at work or school. But you made the effort to come here. And so think about why, what the intentions are you want to get from this. And as is in our tradition, think about benefiting all other sentient beings. So it's funny, as I was preparing my slides for last week and this week, last week I went to add in slides from what we had missed the week before in session two, and they were already there, which means the same thing happened last year. And then I went to add in the slides for tonight. They were already there from last year. So very, very easy to get off track. And there were great questions last week. I told Geshe-la we were here for a long time with questions. So you probably have questions from last week. Talk. I knew I shouldn't have brought my phone in here. So we have several things we're going to do tonight. One is going to be a review, and it will be a pretty good review of karma, since we didn't finish that topic. And then we're going to talk about how we purify. And then we're also going to look at precious human rebirth. We talked about that just a little bit, and we'll go into more detail. The Buddhist view of death. the three scopes of the Lam Rim, and then the three principal aspects of the path. Maybe, if we get there. We'll see. And then, of course, karma. So, for our review, I mean, we've covered a lot in a short period of time. I'm always amazed at how much gets covered in these sessions. But, you know, we talked about Shakyamuni Buddha's life. How did he become a Buddha, and what does that mean? We talked about the history of our center, the spread of Buddhism from India, you know, throughout Asia and then to the West, our lovely center, and our founders, Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe, who founded FPMT, which we fall under, and then Don Brown, who actually got this center started and brought Robbie Watkins, our center director, here. We talked about the mind and what mind is from a Buddhist psychology and philosophy, and then the Four Noble Truths, which was the Buddha's first teaching, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma. And then karma. So, do you have questions on any of the first five before we get to karma? Remember, if you have any questions or comments, we use the microphone to make those. There's our microphone. And then we can pass it around. All right. Well, if any pops up, just feel free to interrupt me and ask. So I can't remember if I shared this joke last night, but I love it. If you think about it, we must have done something pretty bad in a past life. And we talked about that with karma, right? We can kind of look at our lives and realize, you know, where we might have come from. But more importantly, to think, where do we want to go in our next life? What do we want this custodian of our mind to be like? And we're creating that setting for that person or animal or cockroach, hopefully person. So we mentioned last week that rebirth, mind, karma are all kind of interconnected, and so having that good understanding is really important. So, and this really is the basis of Buddhism, are these three. We talked about how mind is not physical, so it can't come from or be caused by something that's non-physical. It can only come from previous moments of mind, which makes perfect sense on the physical level. We know law of cause and effect in our physical universe, and karma's the law of cause and effect, the psychological law of cause and effect against, I guess, our mind strain. So each moment of mind had a previous moment of mind, and we carried that all the way back. Some have memories from their childhood even. Most of us probably don't have memories in our mother's womb, but we know we were there. Maybe some have pictures of their birth. I mean, we know we were there. And then where were we? Where was mind before that? Where was that subtle mind? Because every moment of mind has to have a previous moment of mind. They actually teach that within every snap of a finger, you have 64 thoughts. And we're not even aware of those. So we're not aware of most things that are going on in our mind streams, including probably for most of us that past mind. So we talked about the definition of karma. Does anybody recall? It's one word that we said karma was. You can just holler it. And action. So karma is defined as action. I heard Rabina define it as intention. It's intention or action. And so it's not just a physical action. It's every action of body, speech, and mind. And with this law of cause and effect, every action of body, speech, and mind leaves an imprint, a little seed on that subtle consciousness. Bless you. And as Venerable Tendrin once said, you know, there's no cosmic scoreboard in the sky. Nobody's keeping score. There's no judgment. You know, the imprints are, it's that psychological imprint that's made on our mind stream, directly on our mind stream. So, we talked about some rules of karma, some principles of karma that we'll review very quickly. But the bottom line with this cause and effect is that positive actions, virtuous actions, virtuous karma always lead to happiness, can't lead to anything else. And non-virtuous, negative actions always lead to suffering, that negative impact on our mind stream. And then we got as far last week as the four laws of karma that we'll just quickly go through, and then we'll talk about the four aspects of karma. And then we can stop for some questions and then move on. So the first one is that karma is definite. Every virtuous action always produces happiness. Every non-virtuous action always produces future suffering. Maybe not in this life, but in some point, in some future life, it will. So, you know, you joke about instant karma, but it's not there. You know, so when that, you know, the person who just flies by you on 40 or 540, you know, and they're weaving in and out of traffic, and they almost cut you off, and I just think, dog, why can't there be a police officer just right up ahead that stops him before he hurts himself or somebody else? And they're never there. You know, karma just doesn't work that way. Then we talked about karma expands over time. So generosity can produce great wealth. Non-virtuous actions will expand as well and produce huge sufferings for us. There is no result without a cause. So we will never experience a result that we haven't created ourselves. Now, you know, our karma might be ripening as a group and we might experience something, but it's not because somebody else is dragging us along with their karma. It's really our own karma. So if another person is going through something and we're going through something similar, the causes and conditions have just ripened that seed of karma. And then there's no result without a cause. Everything we experience came from past karma. So we can only experience the karmic results of our actions. And then the last one is karma is not lost. So every action of body, speech, and mind produces a result. There is no expiration date. You know, just because nobody saw you do it, just because we deny most of what we do in our own mind streams, it's still there. Whether you believe, we haven't met the train yet in this class. So it comes by frequently. And if you can't hear me, I'll pause. But usually I'll just make a wish for who's ever on the train when it goes by, the wish for compassion. It was actually kind of cool. We picked up my grandson in Charlotte because he wanted to ride a train. So we got to go right by here. And I thought, oh. So it's no expiration date. The imprints are there until we purify or destroy them. They're there. We can lessen them as well. And the one thing that I learned is that positive karma, no matter how much positive karma we've accrued, can be completely destroyed by anger. And one angry outburst can destroy that. So, we didn't talk at all about the aspects of karma. And there's four aspects of karma. One thing you'll learn that Buddhists have lists. There's eight of this and ten of that and four and six and seven. And then you start getting all the numbers mixed up. But the first aspect is the ripening result. So this is what type of rebirth we'll take, human, etc. And the ripening result isn't necessarily our next rebirth. It could be multiple rebirths from now that something that we've done ripened. So we never know. So right now we might have it pretty good, but in our next life, some seed of karma, not so virtuous actions that we've done, may have the causes and conditions to ripen. And then a lot of the ripening results can come at the time of death as well, and what kind of death we have, and we'll talk about that a little bit tonight too. And then there's the possessed result. So what type of environment? Oh, thank you.
Question, and I don't know if this makes any sense, but say that you in this life became enlightened. However, in your karma, past karma, you did something bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so technically in your next life, you're supposed to reap those rewards. But you reached enlightenment in this life. Does that go away now?
It goes away. So the deal's off. So if you've become enlightened, you've purified all that negative karma completely. Even though in your past life you could have, we all have, right? In our past lives we've murdered, we've stole, all kinds of things. But when you become enlightened, you've eliminated all that. Thank you.
It says, like, the possessed result, like, what environment we are born into. Does that, like, factor into, like, abusive households or something like that, like the environment, or is that, like, different?
It can. So you have a macro environment, right, and you have a micro environment. So the possessed result is, like, what we're born into. So, and that can be, I mean, you were born in the United States, where we have every luxury most of us could want. We have clean water. We have education. We, for the most part, have food. Nobody's starving. There are people who are hungry and somewhat malnourished, but we don't have massive starvation here. We're not a war-torn country. Hard to tell that sometimes when you watch the news, but we're not. And you think about, what if we were born somewhere where there wasn't food or there was war? I can remember being very young. That was my first where I thought, I mean, I was raised Catholic, and that was my first where I thought, no, this something's not right with this picture. But I asked, the people in Bangladesh were starving at that time, and I said, why? Why were they born there? Like, why were they born there and we're here where we have everything? And, you know, the nuns were the first one that said, because it's God's will. And then my mom and dad said the same thing, it's God's will. And I thought, why? I kept asking why, and nobody could answer that. Like, why would a God, a baby be born where they don't have any control over where they were born, and yet I'm here and have so much, And karma would explain that, this possessed result. And then it also is, on that micro level, are we born into an abusive family? Are we in an abusive relationship? Now, it doesn't mean we can't change that or deal with it, because we can change and deal with things all the time, right? But sometimes you can't. And then experiencing the result similar to the cause. So you're robbed because you robbed from somebody in the past. You stole in the past. And so you're robbed now. You're lied to now because you lied to somebody in the past. So we experience the result of our past karma, our past actions. And then creating the results similar to the cause is our tendencies or habits. So this is where we repeat our actions. So we steal now, because we stole in the past. Maybe we're good at it. Maybe we like it. We kill now because we've killed in the past. Venerable Rabina talks about somebody who, they were a Buddhist family, and their six-year-old son loved the fish, and the parents would do everything to talk them out of fishing, but he got the biggest joy out of fishing. And so, and whatever in his past life, he created the causes to do that now. Easy to see even with things like sports, music, those kinds of things. You practice enough in your past life that young kids are pretty good in this life at playing a musical instrument or whatever it might be that they're good at now. Thank you.
Just have a question. So the way I've been seeing it, and I don't know if karma falls into my thoughts, but for example, if I see somebody who is is very attached to materials, I kind of see a pattern in them losing that material, or getting a brand new car, and next day they have it crushed, and I see this over and over and over again, and I'm like, maybe it's a way of teaching detachment, not being attached to materials, or we're being robbed to teach you a lesson, which is not be attached to that laptop, and I don't know, is karma is always involved. I don't know, because I was sure it was you just have to learn certain things in life, and it's going to keep coming back until you learn to not be so attached to materials. You know what I mean?
So not being attached to material things is part of what we have to learn, right? But then we also have to learn why are we attached, that process of letting go, which we'll talk about a little bit tonight. And then other things in Buddhism, what is reality, which helps us then loosen that attachment we have to material things. But you can, sometimes I'll see it in myself, just glaring how attached I am to some things. And often, you see it in other people, and then that's always a good reminder to me. Oh, you don't want to be attached, or, try not to be attached to things. So when you have more, you would think we would be less attached to it. But that's not true. The more we have, you start grabbing it more. And so often countries where people have nothing and yet they're happier, have more life satisfaction than we do. They smile, they're generous with what they have. So there's some truth to that, but that's not the whole picture.
But karma, is it just I robbed in my previous life, that's why somebody's stealing my computer? Or it could also be I didn't rob, but I've been very attached to materials, and now karma is being translated into me being robbed.
It could be. It could be that we're real attached in our past life, so now we're things are getting stolen from us now. But I often hear it as if we're being robbed, we robbed in our past life. And if we're robbed often and of large things, who knows? Maybe we stole something from the Dharma. I mean, who knows what we could have stolen in the past? Karma is such a complex, deep subject that, oh my gosh, who knows when it ripens, what the causes and conditions are, and why it ripens the way it does.
Thank
you. That's a good point. Now I understood what your question was.
You said earlier that a moment of anger sort of wipes out all of your previous...
I don't believe that. No, go ahead.
...good karma. And it's funny, it's one of the things that I've noticed, as I've gotten stronger and older, I will occasionally get angry. And it's weird to experience because it's not something I've had a lot of. But why is that? And what does that have to do with your karma? Why is that considered such a bad thing that it wipes out your...
Well, I'm glad you asked. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. It's just that powerful. It's that strong of a negative action that it's like a poison. It's that harmful to us. I know. And that's a habit that's so ingrained in us, I mean, so ingrained that I feel good if I just recognize I'm getting angry. I know. But those are the habits we have to change. And we can, right? That's the beauty of all this. We know, and neuroscience has taught us that. We talked about this. We know we can, it's not just Buddhism telling us this. We can change our habits. Well, go ahead.
No.
Would you say no? She
get angry.
Go ahead. She'll get angry if she asks this.
Is the thought to diminish anger through meditation and mindfulness?
Oh, so can you, yes and no. So can you diminish anger through meditation and mindfulness? That's what helps us recognize anger, right? And then through meditation and mindfulness, we can think about patience or what we want to do instead of anger and kind of start planting those thoughts. And then you have to find instances where you practice. We only get better when we practice. So we want to catch anger when it's a little bit of frustration, just a little, that little nudge, and then we, you know, like sometimes I'll laugh at it, you know, label it. There's that anger, and where is it? Like, where is it? Is it in my stomach? Is it in my head? Like, where is it in my body? Where is this coming from? That kind of wipes it out right there. And then you find opportunities to practice. So at first, you just want to avoid the things that make you angry. I'm still, for the most part, in that stage. And so avoiding's good, because then you're not, I feel like at least I'm not accruing more anger. But you have to find ways to practice so that if standing in lines you start getting frustrated, then go to the DMV and renew your driver's license in the busiest time of the month. You know, pick the longest line at the grocery store. Try driving the speed limit on 40. Just drive the speed limit. And then you can watch the anger wish by you without having to feel like you have to get caught in that. So here's the next slide that we can do, because we're all human, right? And we're all practicing. And until we're enlightened, that quickly, just because we want to stop getting angry, it's not going to happen in a wish. So it takes practice and it takes time. But we can purify. And so these are the four opponent powers: regret, reliance, remedy, and resolve, the four R's. So there's a couple of ways that we can diminish karma, stop the causes and conditions, and purify. So we can regret what we've done. But, you know, regret is the first step. I regret I'm angry. I regret I lied or exaggerated or whatever it might be. And then, but it's not like words are empty, right? Regret is just this heartfelt, oh my gosh, if I keep getting angry, I'm going to wipe out all the positive good things I do. And I don't want to create these habits. Like, you regret it from your heart that you don't want to do this anymore. And then you rely on whatever you go to that helps you to overcome that anger. If you're Christian, you would rely on God and Jesus. Here we rely on the three jewels, the Buddha Dharma Sangha, the Guru Dharma Sangha, or some people will say four, Guru Buddha Dharma Sangha. You apply a remedy, and so it could be, in the Catholic Church, you would say whatever. Who else was Catholic in here? There were a few. 10 Hail Marys or a rosary or whatever it might be. And it's not the same here. If you lie, you would want to make sure you go back and you apologize and you tell the person the truth. If you kill, you always try not to kill again. Or
mm-hmm.
This is kind of a brutal question, but I think it's meant to be heard. And that is suffering part of the remedy for bad karma? Like, in other words, if I have really bad karma and I suffer, maybe it's minuscule, maybe it's really heavy, but is that suffering in a way almost like the cleansing of that karma or the remedy for that ailment or something like that?
Yes and no. So we talked about that last week, right? You never... Suffering's... We want out of suffering, right? So you never suffer as part of a remedy. However... when we suffer, one way to look at it from a Buddhist perspective is that what we've eliminated that negative karma that caused us to suffer. So that's not seen as a remedy, it's a purification. So it's a difference in term. So, Steve was here last week and he shared the story about the monk who was in the moped accident and broke both of his legs. And they all went to the hospital and celebrated. And I know, I've broken a couple of bones, but the most recently was my right elbow. And Geshe Songpo, the first thing he said when he saw me, "Oh, I'm so happy. I rejoice for you." And, you know, it's just like, it's not the same way we think, you know, but I can't tell you how much that helped me. It was like, oh yeah, just because I can't drive and I can't sleep and I can't blow dry my hair, this is a good thing. But I would never wish to break my other arm so that I would purify suffering. So, right, but when things happen, so whether it's true or not, it helps us. And that makes it true because it helps our mind stream. Because we add suffering to suffering. Something happens and, man, we pile it on. You know, oh, the woe is me and everything bad. You know, we pile it on. And that stops that immediately. Yes. Wait.
Thank you. I have one question about karma or how does Buddhism takes when someone has a mental illness and hurts somebody else, how does that work? Does that cause karma or is just to have that illness in this life the effect of past karma?
So mental illness, just like physical illness, is a result of our karma. I couldn't tell you what the cause was. I mean, there... Right now, Stephanie Smith is teaching karma. It's 5 weeks long, and they're not even scratching the surface. So this is barely an introduction to the subject. But mental illness is part of karma. So if somebody has a mental illness and they don't realize the harm we're doing, if we could prevent that from happening, but often we can't. This is samsara, right? But I would also caution us that we all have mental illness, and we all do terrible things out of ignorance, and we do it. But it doesn't get us off the hook, right? If a robin eats a worm, they ate the worm. Now, robins only doing what they know how to do, right? But they still ate the worm. Same with us, or somebody with mental illness. We still create karma, whether we know we are or not. Now, it's less when it's not intentional, and we can't judge whether something's intentional or not, right?
So, if someone with a mental illness does hurt or kill people, that does create negative karma. So, if it creates negative karma and they have negative actions happen to them as a result, what if they're reborn into another person with another mental illness and the same thing ends up happening to them? What if it just happens over and over?
It'll happen. Groundhog Day. All of us. It will happen over and over because we're creating the causes and conditions for it to happen. We're creating the habit, right? So then hopefully they see a prayer flag. They walk around a stupa. Geshe-la says just walking around a stupa purifies and creates huge merit. Like, I mean, like, huge merit. Just, we might not understand it, but just walking around the stupa. And so I've brought my dog here and walked around the stupa. So beings that don't even know, don't have a clue, I didn't want her to come back as another dog again. You know, I want her to have a chance to practice. And I thought, well, maybe walking around that stupa would help. Who knows? Who knows? Somebody else raised their hand. Yes. I'm sorry? What? Oh, what's a stupa? So a stupa is that large, beautiful piece of sculpture we have up there, out there, which is a symbol of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind, right? It's filled with holy objects to the top. There's all kinds of holy relics in there and mantras and blessed objects. And actually, we built that all ourselves, our volunteers. I'll say the collective we. I probably mixed up something to hand to somebody and painted a little. But we have a Tibetan artist who actually moved to our community 5 or 6 years ago. He's been here for a little while. And he painted our stupa for us and designed it. So tonight, walk around it. Every time you come to the center, walk around it. And you walk clockwise around it. Always walk clockwise around.
She has a question.
This might be just a touch off subject, but I feel like it about purification. I know that in Buddhism, you know, there's no blind faith required. But it's not too closed-minded either. It's like a healthy skepticism and a healthy faith.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about purifying negative karma and things, some of these things, you know, like the philosophy of a lot of this, to me, it just rings true, like in my heart, in my body. It's like, yes, I yes, you know. But then some of these other ideas, to me, it would require me to take it on blind faith, in a sense. So how do we, as like when we're new to Buddhism, how do we not do something out of blind faith, but give it a chance or something? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I don't want to say anything incorrect. So you don't take anything by blind faith, right? It's that you ask questions, you consider your own experience, and then some things like rebirth for a while, it was like, meh. I'll put that on the shelf, you know, until I was willing to jump into Buddhism. I struggled with karma for a while because I just couldn't grasp the whole concept. It took me several years before I actually took refuge, you know, where I felt like, okay, I still not sure, but my own experience has told me this is right. But you can't, there's different kinds of faith, right? So not so much blind faith, but you could have this trust faith where you know the Buddha taught it. You know His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches it and is a model for all of us. Geshe-la. So I never said that about priests. But so you kind of start thinking that way, but Geshe-la will tell you, like with purification, it's your own experience. Because I'll say, bless you, I'm saying all these mantras, I'm doing all these things to purify. I still regret. I still know it's not purified. Like I know I'm carrying this weight around. And it's not one time. It's a process, right? So he says, you keep trying it. He said, do you feel better when you do this? Yes. Okay, good. Keep doing it. And then you have certain dreams. So it's always your own experience. And I don't remember what the dreams are, like a white snow mountain and you dream about it, or an elephant doing something, or, you know, you can ask Steep. Steep would probably remember that. So do you have Steep's email? You have mine email. I'll put it back to the beginning, write it down, and then I'll give it to Steve. Then Steve will give you, but that, it's still your own experience, and then you realize, oh, I have finally purified whatever it is you're trying to purify.
I would just add that His Holiness says if, you know, you find a tenet in Buddhism that does not work for you, that you cannot accept, then you just put it aside and take the benefit that you get from the rest of the teachings from it. That it's your obligation to reject things that you don't believe in Buddhism. That's how I understand it. Maybe I've not said
it
the same way.
No, it's the way I understand it, too. You accept the things that you can, and you just... I think they say, like, put it on the shelf or put it aside and come back to it periodically. And I can say every time I've done that and come back to something, it makes more sense.
But if you shelf, like, a part of it, right, then you can never reach enlightenment, correct? Because you are not fully there.
Well, I think technically on some level, but who knows when we'll become enlightened or what we do to become enlightened. So you might shelve something. You might say, I'm not quite sure about rebirth. I don't have any experience with it. I'm just not quite sure. I'm going to put it on the shelf. And who knows, you might do some amazing act or have some major breakthrough, and you become enlightened anyhow because the causes and conditions ripened. But yes, technically we practice all aspects. But I've kept things on a shelf for a long time. Yes. And then you had something else again too, right? Okay, we'll come back.
I have two questions. The first one might sound silly, but are all Buddhists vegetarian?
No, that's not a silly question at all. No.
Okay.
Most are not. I don't know if most is, see, I exaggerate. I don't know if most is true. No, all Buddhists are not vegetarians. I'll end it there.
Okay, so my next question is, how do Buddhists differentiate between a murder as being bad karma, where you take someone's life away, and then also, like, with obviously eating meat, you're taking a life away, but the karma is still continuing, or that animal's karma is going to continue and be reborn into something else or someone else.
Were you going to answer that? Go ahead.
It also all depends on intention as well as, it just depends on intention as well. Like, because you're not, a lot of people aren't killing the food. They're buying it from the supermarket where it's already been killed. So the best thing to do would be to use the meat that's already killed. Because it's just going to go to waste regardless. And wasting is also creating negative karma. And whenever you shower as well, you kill microorganisms all over you, which is creating negative karma as well. Walking does. You kill organisms like all the time. And it doesn't differentiate in the amount of karma you lose or amount of bad karma you gain. It all depends on your intention.
So it's intention, it's respect. It's in Tibet, you know, they have little protein sources. So they ate meat. In India, they ate meat. His Holiness was on a plane once and somebody saw him eating meat. And the person gasped and said, I thought Buddhists don't kill or don't eat, are vegetarians. And he said, only the good Buddhists. That's a true story. But, you know, I heard Venerable Rabina say, I can't even imitate her voice, but you vegetarians think you're so high and mighty. And, you know, she wags her finger and she said, we kill all the time. Like, when you garden, you're killing insects. You know, she said that organic gardeners are some of the worst because you bring in other bugs. You bring in ladybugs to kill other bugs. So you are hiring hitmen, you know? And so she, you know, so it's degrees, right? So you know, if you eat meat, you eat it with respect. I don't know all the answers, but that helped. Who was next? Yes.
Earlier, this kind of brought up my question, was you said, like, the robin ate the worm, so that's still karma, but what else would it eat?
That's right.
So should it just die?
That's right. So think about that. Animals don't have much chance to get out. They don't have much chance to practice. That's our next topic for tonight is this precious human rebirth. So we will come back to that, but that's right. And then your hand went up too in the back, Hedy, whenever.
Oh, sorry.
No, you come up here, I just wanted to remember. But yeah, that's right. So one time I saw a bee stuck in a spider. This was in a spider web. This was when I first started practicing. This was probably 2003 or 2004. Well, I've done a couple of stupid things, but this was one. And I just panicked. Oh my gosh, the spider's going to eat it. Wasn't even thinking about the karma the spider was going to get. My whole sympathy was for the bee. So I freed it. And then I probably caused that spider to starve to death. You know, who knows? And then one time I freed a wasp that was so tangled in the web that it couldn't fly. So its suffering had to be horrendous compared to just getting eaten. And so sometimes we do things thinking we're doing the right thing, but we don't have the wisdom to know what the right thing is. So who knows? We create negative karma all the time.
So going back to the vegetarian is, yes, we don't, you know, the meat is there at the supermarket. We eat it because it's already dead. But it's already dead because there is demand. So if the demand goes there, then animals don't get killed. And I don't know, like, if anybody's seen the suffering of a cow or any animal, like, dying, you know, like fish and pigs and chickens and all these things, like I actually found out this past weekend, that Buddhism is not based on vegetarianism, and I was, like, really surprised how you kill an animal, then you purify the act, and then you can eat it. Like, yeah, this way I can just, like, whoever makes me mad, I kill them, and then I just purify it, and then I move on. So I'm
that's
like,
why it's not that simple. And in Buddhism, well, they're not vegetarians, and they don't promote not right. I mean, His Holiness will say he supports it. Ricardo, who's the happiest monk? The guy with the things on his head, Ricardo Matthew. I think it's Matthew. Oh, my gosh. He's got a new book out. Incredible. But he's the one they did all the studies on. They hooked him up to EKGs. You see his picture in the in National Geographic. But he was never a vegetarian. But he saw the suffering of animals. Like, and he's a pretty high-realized being as well. But and so he has a whole book out on veganism and vegetarianism. So you go with your heart and what is right for you, and then you don't judge what other people do. You know, it's hard, but
I guess I just want to say when we were in Tibet, we noticed a whole bunch of Buddhists eating a whole bunch of yak and beef
yak
and goat, and so we asked the guy, and he said, "Well, it's a cold environment, not a lot of vegetables, and that's just the way it is."
That's right, and so it's hard. And then for health reasons, people need to that protein source or to eat that meat. Yeah.
I know it's in the way.
Ask it. You waited so long. No.
I was going back again to the question about how this thing can purify, or what's the logic behind it. Just by walking around, you purify. But that's why I say it can wait.
Yeah, I don't understand it, but I walk around that stupa every time I come. I've driven here and walking around that stupa because I trust. You know, I might not feel better when I leave. I always feel better after I do that. Always. Were you going to ask something? No? Okay.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things about walking around the stupa for me, or the little bit of meditation that I do, is, if nothing else, my mind is in a positive state then.
That's right.
And that's what I'm striving for, is to have my mind in as positive a state as possible most of the time. So those are little victories for me.
That's
the
right.
Easy ones.
Yeah, that's huge, right? Good, thanks. Yes.
The vegetarian talk really got me questioning again about it, because I go back and forth with it too. And I had some ideas, and again, I don't know if they're just thoughts in my head, but the idea that if you care about the highest good that you can do, so, for example, you know, if you believe in, like, the hell realms and the animal realm and the human realm, the animal, in a sense, you know, maybe the animal came from, like, a hell realm, and now the animal has exhausted its negative, you know, its animal and negative karma, and so now if you wish it, you know, positive rebirth, you're, in killing it, you're, in a sense, freeing it from its animal constraints or something. And also, in feeding a human, because it's a better state to attain enlightenment, and through attaining enlightenment, we're helping all sentient beings. The animal, in a sense, is gaining positive karma by feeding you as a human, because then you're attaining, you're getting closer to enlightenment.
So, I hear what you're saying. Who knows? Maybe, but what I've heard about that is an animal probably doesn't have that intention. An animal can't have the intention of I'm helping humans, right? And we can't give the animal that intention. Unfortunately, I try it all the time. we can't give it to them. They have to get their own karma, and then the other thing with that is, if you kill an animal, even to eat it because you're starving, you've prevented them playing out their own karma. We've intervened. So it doesn't help their karma at all. So, like, I had somebody joking, you know, cockroaches only live for 2 weeks, so I killed it at 13 days. Whoops. Well, no, you killed it at 13 days. It should have lived out its karma, kind of a thing. I don't know, you know, whatever. I don't even know if it's true. And listen, you're listening to an amateur. I'm answering these the best I can. But you know, ask other people, question, read.
So I guess really the best defense for any kind of, like, karmic debts that you would have to pay out, whether as being a bird 10 times because you keep dying because you can't find food, it's really up to us while we're here, right, to kind of, like,
find out what we do that is, I guess, bad, or, like, not necessarily, oh, I didn't, you know, get a 100 on my geometry exam, or, like, I didn't
right.
clean that window super perfectly, like, I missed a little bit.
Kinda. It's probably a whole lot more complicated than that, but we do more good things than we do bad things, right? So we're only focusing on the negative here. So remember all the good you do. That's huge to remember, and actually they say to rejoice in that. And then, you know how you read something in the paper and somebody does, like, a Mother Teresa act, and you think, well, dog, how, you know, they had the karma to do that, and I want to be a philanthropist, and I don't have any money, and, you know, you go down that road. Geshe-la says you rejoice when other people do good things. So if somebody saves people or donates money that you don't have, if you rejoice in their action and you set the wish, may I one day have enough money to give it all away, you reap the exact same positive karmic benefits. And so it's human nature to go to the negative, and then we do need to get back on track. Probably to go to the negative because this is what, it was a survival of the species, right? It was, you know, watch out or you're going to get eaten or run over or whatever the case may be. But we kept it, we keep that today. And we have this tendency to go to the negative, and we can break that tendency and go to the positive. But you're right. Through mindfulness, we begin to be aware what mind we want to create, what positive actions we want to do. And one of the prayers in Buddhism, the foundation of all good qualities, which we'll talk a little bit about next week, says, may I completely abandon all negative actions and only accomplish virtuous deeds. That's our wish. Will we ever be able to do it? Not until we're enlightened perfectly, but you see people get close all the time. You know, we can do that. We can abandon negative actions. And then we're going to talk about killing here in a second, but as far as grocery store and it's already dead, I do that. My fetish is, you know, shoes and purses, and I always try to find something that's not leather, you know, because then what's the point of being a vegetarian, right? And then I justify it. Well, it was already dead. Might as well make use of it, right? That's our attachment, right? I mean, that's our own attachment justifying what we want. But they say it's far worse to kill the animal ourselves and rejoice in the kill. So I think about these big game hunters, and you see these unfair hunt. Now you can hunt in a hibernating bear's den, and then you gloat about doing that. Like, that's got to just have a huge hit. Huge hit. So, you guys are awesome. I love these discussions. So we'll go a little bit more, and then we'll have more, unless anybody else had a burning question. Do you have a burning question? She's saying no. Okay. So, and then you resolve. So the other important R is you resolve not to do it again. Now, there's some things that I will say, may I not do this before I get up off this cushion. Sometimes I say 5 seconds, literally, especially when it comes to negative mind, because, man, you know, whatever. And so some things you can say, yeah, may I not kill anything today? And if you don't drive, you might be able to do that, right? So there's some things that you try to resolve not to do, and you can set the time frame, but then catch it when you do it. I have said things like, may I not think a negative thought for 5 seconds, and bam, I haven't even gotten that out of my mouth, and I thought of something bad, you know? So anyhow, okay. So these are the 10 non-virtuous actions that are going to sound a lot like the 10 commandments, but there's a difference. There is a little bit of a difference. And so these aren't to blame or judge, right? And nobody's keeping score. And we don't do it because a God said we shouldn't do these actions, or our mother, or whoever, the priest, whoever it might be. We do it because they're non-virtuous and they harm us as much as they're harming the other sentient being, right? So it's the seeds. It's the habit that we want to develop, and it's the seeds we want to sow. And that's really the biggest difference between the 10 non-virtuous actions. And it really connects karma to the ethical behavior we want to practice. So the ethical behavior is actually the opposite of these. So killing, if we take another life for whatever reason, and human life has greater karmic hit than an animal or an insect, but all of it's killing. Stealing, taking something that was not freely given to you. So think about that. I pick up pens. Who took the pen tonight? I pick up pens all the time with the intention of giving them back. I forget. I have a whole collection of pens. I don't even know where they came from. I seashells. I took this very literally. I have seashells, had seashells all over my house. Bags of them. Bags and bags. rafts full of them. So I freed them last year. I took them all to the beach. And I freed the seashells because were they given to me again, you know, taken away over the top. Sexual misconduct, which is usually assault. You know, it would be by force. So those are the three non-virtuous actions of body. And then we have four of speech. And so it's lying, which any lie, including exaggeration, because that creates the habit to lie. We're creating that same habit. Harsh speech, which is anger harming another. Slander, which is divisive speech, and you purposefully say something to divide people. Dog. Did it today. Gossip. Idle speech, or just what we do all day long, all the gossip, the idle speech that's not very meaningful. Is it harmful? Probably. And probably the harm is we could have done something virtuous instead of gossip. But slander, harsh speech, and lying are definitely non-virtuous actions, as is gossip. And then the last one is three of mind, and it's covetousness, so jealousy, greed, ill will, or those angry feelings towards others. The example I often hear about anger, it's like drinking a poison and hoping the other person gets sick or dies, or having a hot coal that you're going to throw at somebody, but you burn yourself in the action of throwing that hot coal. So the destruction and the poison to ourself is huge. Wrong view, it's, you know, thinking that if another suffers, it's just their karma. Or if you harm somebody, you can say, well, that was their karma to be harmed. And that's a completely wrong view of karma, which many of us have. And you don't ever rejoice in, oh, that's their karma, you know. It's just not that way. And then you can also use wrong view to justify harm you cause, and you think it's positive. We do that a lot. So when you think about these non-virtuous actions, you think about them in ways as no one wants to suffer, right? We all want our happiness. Now, we're all not very skillful at finding happiness, but that's you know, all of our problems. And so it's easy to see the unskillfulness in other people. We tend to judge other people by their behaviors, but we judge ourselves by our intentions. And so we have to consider, we don't know what somebody's intentions are, right? So we never know if somebody has good or bad intentions. And then part of the causes, which we've talked about, is we're creating our future self when we perform or we do any of these non-virtuous actions. We're creating those tendencies, and we're definitely creating the conditions to either be lied to be killed, to not be trusted. Can you imagine there's people like that today, when they say something, you automatically question if they're even telling the truth anymore. Maybe because they said so many lies or non-truths. Questions, comments about the 10 non-virtuous actions? So we have three principal aspects of the path, which are part of the Lam Rim, which we've talked about in here, which is the graduated path to enlightenment. So we have renunciation, we have bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. So the Lam Rim was written by Lama Tsongkhapa, who was a great yogi in Tibet. I thought it was the 11th century, but Steve said the 13th century, so somewhere between the 11th and the 13th century. And he gave the Lamrim is three volumes, and it's really a meditation. Like he wrote down, he didn't write down, somebody else wrote it down, but he told the story of his life's meditation, his life's work. And so when you read the Lamrim, you read it as if it's a meditation. It's not like a school book that you're trying to learn and flip through. You're learning it slowly. You're meditating on it. You're sitting with it, kind of a thing.
How long?
Oh. There are three volumes that are that thick. But it's not a hard read. So you have, and we'll talk a little bit about the scopes of it, but they're pretty thick documents. But you'll read it over and over again. So you start it, you finish the three, you go back to volume one, you start all over again, you know. And every time you read it, something else jumps out at you. And Geshe-la will do teachings on the Lamrim. Actually, he just finished up, a teaching on Wednesday nights in our Wednesday night program, which I'll also talk about in a few minutes. But it's a great teaching on the Lamrim because you can never hear it enough. At one point, he actually told us to memorize the outline, which is pages. I think the outline is 17 pages long. You know, in their tradition, they memorize since children. So it's a different learning style than ours. But it really, in the Lamrim, it explains how to live everyday life. So if we read it, it's what we do. It's the actions we take with our body, speech, and mind. And that's what Lama Tsongkhapa is teaching us how to do. This is the path to the cessation of suffering. If we want to end this, we follow this path. This is the path we follow. And if you recall, we do this in our tradition, the Mahayana tradition, you're doing it for your own enlightenment, but you want to get enlightened to help other people become enlightened, all sentient beings to become enlightened. So, one thing I just thought of when you mentioned that about, like birds, like robins, how will they ever get out? Like, you know, you can say a mantra when you fill up a bird bath. Fill up your bird bath and make a wish that they become enlightened. Feed them. You can do so much that even without realizing, you could be impacting their karmic stream. So there's all kinds of little things we can do to make life better for them. Put a bird feeder up. Maybe they won't eat the worms. I actually had somebody say they put a bird feeder up, the cockroaches got on the bird feeder, and the birds ate the cockroaches. So, you know, we all have intentions, but don't always play out the way we want to at all. And then the foundation of all good qualities is a few pages. We'll actually read that next week. It's, I forget how many stanzas, but that is a complete synopsis of all three volumes of the Lamrim. So just reading the foundation of all good qualities and memorizing that is a good thing to do. So, renunciation. And then we might get through this, and then I may stop there, and then we'll finish up next week. So the first one is that heartfelt wish to be free of suffering, completely out. You want out. You want to stop cyclic existence. It's not just when things are bad that you say, oh, you know, I want out, I've had it. It's even when things are good that you still see the suffering. You see it all around you. You know that the only way out is to completely renunciate. And the quote in the Foundation of All Good Qualities is to generate the mind that unceasingly recognizes this. You know, you just want out. It's that heartfelt and strong. Bodhicitta is that altruistic intention to become enlightened, not just for yourself, but so that you can help others become enlightened. Because once we're Buddhas, we'll know whether we should free that bee from that spider web or not. We'll know it without even thinking about it. We'll know exactly what the right thing to do is, because we'll have wisdom and compassion. But we're doing this to help and benefit other people, not just for ourselves. We have to get enlightened first in order to know what to do and how to do that. And then to have that wisdom of the right view of how things really exist, which we'll talk about a little bit next week. So those are the three principal aspects: renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom of emptiness. All right, we'll talk about these definitions, and then we'll end there, and we'll take it up next week, because I have a meditation that I want to do with you on equanimity. So the first definition is this aspect of loving kindness, which is part of bodhicitta in Buddhism. To love somebody, that loving kindness is the wish for them to be happy. There is no attachment. So we should wish and love everybody. It's the wish for all beings, all sentient beings, to be happy. That's love. Compassion is the wish that all sentient beings not suffer. You might start with yourself. You don't want to suffer. Branch it out to your family, friends, pets. You don't want them to suffer, and then just keep expanding it, keep expanding it, keep expanding it. Nobody wants to suffer. Compassion is that wish. And then equanimity is you see this equally for all beings, not just for your friends, your loved ones, the people who look like us, all beings, our enemies, people who harm us, people that we have whatever aversion to, you treat with equanimity, loving kindness and compassion. His Holiness has said he considers that bodhicitta, that loving compassion, as the, he calls it selfishness on the grandest scale, because we get the greatest pleasure. We get the most positive karma from that. So, you know, he says to be truly happy, have compassion. For all others, instead of how we usually operate, me first and then other people. So, I did want to talk about that. That's all right. We're going to talk about that next week. We're going to get through the other topics. And two things that is there any questions or comments before we do this meditation on equanimity? Bless you. So, this is from Kathleen McDonald's book, and this was her original book, quite old. Oh, 84, I thought it was older than that. There's lovely meditations in here. Any of you who are interested in meditation, I encourage you to take the Meditation 101 class. It'll come up after this one. So go ahead and sit in a comfortable position, and we'll make this a shortened version, but you'll get the idea. So take a few deep breaths. Let go of your questions about karma, although this is kind of related. And just, this is an analytical meditation. So think about what I'm saying and really try to feel it as much as you can. Try to experience it. So normally we discriminate. We either like, dislike, or are indifferent to everyone we meet. It's mostly self-centered. If somebody's agreeable and gives us what we want, we like them. If they're disagreeable or uninteresting to me, then we don't. Our belief in this is because of the I we believe in. It gives rise to the desire to protect and nourish me, the I. Everything we do is for the sake of this self. It has needs that must be fulfilled. It must find happiness and avoid pain. That I likes this person because she or he makes it happy, and dislikes that person because he or she caused it pain. Everything is seen from the perspective of this I. The more we cling to this unreal I and try to fulfill its demands, the deeper we bury ourselves in problems. Our classification of people into friends, enemies, and strangers is probably the best example of this. We assume that the person we like has inherently good qualities, and we exaggerate those qualities. And the person we dislike is inherently bad. And we behave as if these qualities are permanent and unchanging. We'll always be close to the person we have labeled friend, and we'll never be close to the person we dislike. Could you imagine that? So first, focus on your friend. Bring them to mind. Allow your feelings for him or her to arise. Feel your conviction of how good and wonderful and beautiful this person is, and that they are definitely your friend. That is, a person who is good to you and satisfies your needs. Feel how you really want this person to be happy. They make you happy. You want them to be happy. And just really immerse yourself in these good feelings. Now turn to your enemy. And you can take that loosely, but a person you don't like, someone who's not kind to you, maybe they really did something really mean or harmful to you, who does not satisfy your needs, annoys you, makes you angry, probably hurts you. Look carefully at this man or woman and carefully note your feelings. And then finally turn to the so-called stranger, this person you know a little but whom you neither like nor dislike. Maybe it's somebody you see at your workplace, somebody you pass on the street, somebody you saw coming in here but you just didn't even think about them one way or the other. And think about and note your feelings of indifference. And just recognize that the basis for your relationships to these three people is solely what they do or don't do for you, at least at this point in time. So given the Buddhist view that our minds are beginningless, it follows that everyone in here has been our friend, our enemy, and a stranger countless times before. So isn't it reasonable to be kind to your enemies now because they have been your friend before? So return to your friend and imagine a situation, and maybe it's a friend that this has happened with in the past. A situation that would cause the relationship to end. Your friend turned against you, did something that you resented, maybe hurt you. and now you no longer feel warm feelings, no longer wish him or her well. Where is this friend now? Now turn to the present enemy. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together, a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look carefully at the person and your feelings. Are they softening? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemy. This has happened before and will happen again. Why hold so strongly to the concept that there is definitely enemy? In a stranger, imagine how one act of kindness or anger from this person could immediately make him or her a friend or an enemy. There is no inherent definite stranger. It's only a label. There's no sound reasons for our feelings of indifference. Think of strangers in here that you've had conversations with, and now they're either an enemy or a friend. And keep three people in front of you, friend, enemy, stranger, and think about how fragile and impermanent these relationships are. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness as much as you. In this respect, everyone is equal. Everyone deserves to be happy and not suffer. Everyone. The differences we see are superficial, based on our mistaken and narrow self-centered viewpoint. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. Now, it doesn't mean you should not discriminate on a practical level. It's necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some, and we're wise to keep our distance from others. This is not a contradiction. The point of this meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, whether they help or harm us at this point in time. So dedicate your positive energy and insight to your own well-being and the well-being and happiness of all as we continue on this path. Dedicate any energy or insight that you gain tonight so that you'll continue to ask questions, study, and learn. So next week we'll talk about the six perfections. Geshe-la just finished a lovely teaching on the six perfections on Wednesdays. We've been studying the Guru Puja for a couple of years now, and part of that was the six perfections. So we'll review it quickly. He spent like 2 weeks on each of the six, probably longer than that, and skimmed the surface. Sundays, he talks about the six perfections. Geshe Sangpo started teaching about those last Sunday, not this past Sunday. So you'll often hear those discussed. So they're important topics. If you can come on Sundays, that's a great way to listen to some of the teachings. Wednesday nights, the group has been studying together for many years. People come and go all the time. Anybody's welcome to come. It's not like you have to be studying for years, so you can't come to that. Sometimes it's good just to come and sit and listen. The first couple times I came on Wednesday nights, I was so far over my head, so I didn't come for a while. And then I thought, well, that's not very helpful. So I came back, and then you just sit, you listen, you but you're, you know, you've probably completed Buddhism in a nutshell, probably been, not everybody does, but then, or you've probably been studying on your own or in some way on your own. But that, those are lovely teachings, much more in depth than you get on Sundays. And then there's always special teachings going on around here. So look at the calendar. They're all listed on the calendar. We have special pujas that are like a ritual celebration that are wonderful to come to. There's usually two guru pujas and one medicine Buddha puja a month. So there's plenty of ways besides this class. And then there's actually, bless you, then the meditation 101 rolls in. So there's always something that you can come to, especially if you're not ready or even interested in making that transition to discovering Buddhism. So, those of you who weren't here before, the handouts are in the Buddhism in the Nutshell section of our website. We have a book. It's out there, available for purchase, Buddhism in a Nutshell. Geshe-la, a couple of weeks ago, we've been teaching this class for years. It used to be called Buddhism 101. He said, Buddhism in a nutshell. What's in a nutshell mean? So try to explain that to somebody. I said, well, it's like a bite size. Bite size? So I'm trying to use them in sentences. With, you know, we have these weird concepts. Geez, strange. I don't know where that came from. Who knows who thought of in a nutshell. Sure, I can look that up. It's funny, but that's the name of the book, Buddhism in a Nutshell, so we named this class after it. All right. Thank you guys very much. Thank you for coming. Safe travels home. And then I'll see you next week for our last very rich class. It'll be good.